Good morning. It's exciting to be here today. I'm looking forward to all these topics that we have. Not necessarily mine, but I'm looking forward to the ones that are coming by the others and to see what all we can learn today. It's a real privilege to be here. So there's one verse that I'd like to start off with this morning for the topic this morning. It's from Psalm 89, verse 5. It says, "And the heavens shall praise thy wonders, O Lord, thy faithfulness also in the congregation of the saints." So it's telling us two things there, and they're both like a prophecy that's being fulfilled this morning. So the heavens shall praise thy wonders. As we look at the heavens, as we observe them, as we see what's visible in the heavens, they praise the Lord. And as we're together here this morning, I think we could safely say that it's a congregation of the saints. We all profess to believe in God. We have a relationship with Him. So we could call this the congregation of the saints. So as the saints are together this morning, we will see what the heavens are telling us about the Lord. So moving on into the topic here, I don't want to waste time with a lengthy introduction. We'll just go ahead with the topic of astronomy and the Bible and seeing what the heavens tell us about, or the Bible tells us about the heavens around us. So like I said last evening, this picture that you're looking at is made up of multiple single photographs, and just in case you didn't quite understand what I was saying, this here illustrates what I was talking about. These are multiple photographs that have all been moved together into this arrangement here and then just merged into one, and gives you a little bit of an idea of some of the objects that are in space around us. Okay, so now we need to go to the beginning. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God. And this is a verse that we all know well. We believe it. It makes perfect sense that if there's something here in our universe, that there would be someone who actually made it. And as mankind has been looking at the universe throughout centuries and millennia, there have been lots of ideas about how that this all started. And some people don't believe in God. They claim they don't believe in God. So that causes a tremendous problem why we can look out, why you can look out and look up here this morning and you see even fake trees and trim on the walls, a wall here, building, you see people around you. Why is it that you see those things if there is no such thing as a God, no entity in existence that is above the level of a human? And as thinking people thought about these things, most of them assumed, rightly, that there was a creator. Some of them went off the rails and started thinking that these things of the universe just always existed, and they assembled and reassembled themselves until you got to where we got to where we are today. So in the past, there were men who were atheistic philosophers who basically postulated that the universe just always existed, and all those things we see out in space are basically eternal. They're like a god in themselves. Well, there's some problems with that theory, and some of them were quite obvious, but the problems are highlighted by the things, the processes, and the activities that we see in the universe today. For example, the background picture that you see here is the Helix Nebula, and there's a star right here in the center that is shining and giving a testimony of what has been happening around it. This halo, colorful halo of gas, actually came from the star right there in the center. I hope you can see my pointer. For some reason, it's kind of dim this morning. Now, but this here shows us that there are processes happening in this star. The star is maturing. So, like the Bible would say, it's waxing old as doth a garment, and it's going through changes. So it has a finite supply of fuel. There's a limited supply of hydrogen and helium gases in this star. And as time goes on, it's actually expelling some of these gases in this colorful halo of light. It happened at some time in the past. Now you can see the gas envelope expanding out from it. So this star has lost a lot of its fuel, continues to do so, and if it would have been shining throughout eternity past, for an infinite amount of time in the past, it would have run out of fuel by now, and we could no longer see it shining. So that goes for all the stars. If they would have always existed with a finite supply of fuel after an infinite amount of time, which is what we would have now if the universe would have always existed, they would have all run out of fuel. It's like us trying to start an infinite distance away and get here to the seminar this weekend on a single tank of gas. It just wouldn't work. So the stars would have all burned out by today, but today we still see the stars all across the universe declaring God's glory, and there's lots of life and activity here on the earth. So sometime in the relatively recent past, God created everything. And so there were lots of astronomers that understood that there was a beginning because of looking at things like this and other things. And they conceded that there was a beginning, but this stopped right here. So what did that leave us with? But a story of a beginning without a beginner, which of course doesn't get us very far. But there was a new theory that came as a result of that, and it was called the Big Bang Theory. It's a step in the right direction, but it still falls far short of explaining what we see today because it doesn't include God the Creator in it. And it could be summarized in this. Some of you have probably heard or read this before. The belief that there was nothing, and nothing happened to nothing, and nothing magically exploded for no reason, creating everything. And then a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself for no reason whatsoever into self-replicating bits, which then turned into dinosaurs and you and me. Of course, this is not possible. But there are still people that believe in this kind of an occurrence over long periods of time. So the Big Bang Theory isn't necessarily helpful. When you look closely at it, there's basically nothing there to look at. There was just nothingness, and nothing happened to nothing, and that caused everything. So there's a problem here, just getting off the ground with the Big Bang Theory. But just within just a very minute amount of time after the supposed Big Bang happens, there's another problem. And the problem is shown by what we see in the cosmic microwave background today. We see a bunch of static radiation left over in the far reaches of the universe, and it's called the cosmic microwave background. And when we look out there, it takes on a pattern that shows that light and heat have exchanged places and have mixed together far too much to have been caused by something like this. So this is called the horizon problem. When astronomers look out to the horizon, they see this issue. And so there's this issue here that's similar to the light travel time problem. Early in the alleged Big Bang, points A and B start out with different temperatures. Today, points A and B have the same temperature, yet there has not been enough time for them to exchange light and heat, even with the 13.8 billion years that the Big Bang time frame gives or offers. But secular astronomers can't just add more time because then it causes other problems. So it's kind of like a catch-22 situation, and it's a really difficult issue for them. So the point is here, regardless if you accept the Big Bang theory as an explanation for the origin of the universe, or if you take the creation account just 6,000 years ago, there's something going on here that we don't fully understand about how that light and heat have gotten across the universe in the way that it has. So what is the secular astronomer's solution to this problem? We can see how that they have proposed an elaborate and radical cosmic inflation period. It's called the inflation theory, and it is summarized here, where the inflation theory is basically a faster than light expansion shortly after the Big Bang, where the universe expanded 10 to the 78th power times in volume in 1/quintillionth of 1 femtosecond. This equals 1/quintillionth of 1,000,000th of 1,000,000,000th of a second. So less than a blink of an eye, you have a universe that, even though it's already expanding, it undergoes an extremely rapid expansion, expanding 10 to the 78th times bigger in size. Now this is much, much bigger than a trillion or a quadrillion or even a septillion. This number here is 1 followed by 78 zeros. Let's put it that way. So it's an amazing theory, but there's no evidence for it. Back in 2014, there was a team of astronomers that thought they found evidence for the theory, but later on there were other astronomers that looked into it, and they noticed that what they were looking at was not a pattern in the far reaches of the universe, the cosmic microwave background, but just the polarization of dust right here in our own galaxy. So back to square one, no evidence for this theory, the inflation theory, but yet it is one of the threads that are holding up the Big Bang theory, that are propping it up. So why do we believe things like this sometimes as humans? Maybe not us in this room, but mankind as a whole. Well, so we have thinking mechanisms or faulty logic at times. For example, this illustrates it. Which square is darker, A or B? This looks like it has a straightforward answer. Some of you may have seen this before. A looks darker than B, but what I did here, I borrowed this. I don't know who actually put it together, so I don't have a credit here. Once I find out, I can put it in. But what I did was I built a bridge from A to B, and I made it the same color as A, or the same shade, and there you see it. A and B meets up seamlessly, no transition in shade, and yet we can see that, but what this does is it shows us that these are the same darkness, same lightness, however you want to say it. There's no difference between the two, but if we take that away, we're back to looking like A is darker than B. And it's because we're being influenced by this shadow, the cylinder causing the shadow and the other things there. So that is an optical illusion. And the God of this world capitalizes on our weaknesses like this and causes us to believe things that aren't true. Whereas we thought we could make a positive statement about this, that A is darker than B, now we see we are wrong. So we have to be careful. We need a guidebook for our source of truth, and that's the Bible. The Bible has a lot to say about astronomy, so we'll look at that here next. But one thing to remember is that if we don't accept what is the truth of the universe, according to what God has said about it, then we will eventually come to the point of believing things that aren't even rational and right. I think it was G.K. Chesterton that said that the ones who don't believe in God, there's a real danger there. It's not that they are in danger of believing in nothing, but rather that they're in danger of believing anything. And he also said, he who will not have softening of the heart will eventually have softening of the head. And that's a sobering reality. So if we take everything away from the screen except for the A and the B and the bridge, we can see that they clearly are all the same shade. Okay, next we'll take a look at some of these scriptures. Job 9, 8 through 10 says, which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea, which maketh Arcturus, Orion, and Pleiades in the chambers of the south, which doeth great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number. This is from Job 9, verses 8 through 10. So it's talking about the spreading out of the heavens. I want you to hold on to that thought just a little. And it also talks about Arcturus, Orion, and Pleiades. And these here are actually stars, or groups of stars that we still call by the same name today. Arcturus has had a little change there. Orion and Pleiades. Pleiades are also nicknamed the seven sisters or the seven stars. And it's interesting how that we can go out at night and get our Bible. We can take a look at some of these verses and we can read them, and then we can look up and see exactly what God was talking about, or Job was writing about, as he was inspired by God after reading from the Word of God here. So in this, we have those names, those objects that we can connect with. And then in the last verse there, verse 10, it says, which doeth great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number. So this is still in the context of the universe around us. God is doing things past our finding out or beyond our comprehension, and he's making these as wonders without number, beyond our ability to count. So how many stars are there in the universe? We don't know exactly how many there are, but what we can do is get a good estimate of the number of stars in the universe by looking at a certain area of the universe, counting the stars in that small area, or estimating the number of stars within the galaxies in that area, and then doing the same thing in another part of the universe, and again over here and over there, and we can average those numbers together for the amount of stars that would be in that angular diameter of that cross-section of our universe, and then we can extrapolate those numbers to account for the entire universe all around us, and we can get an estimate of the number of stars believed to be within the universe. And the number is so big that it wouldn't do us any good to actually quote the number this morning. We couldn't understand it. We couldn't comprehend it. But one thing we could do is do like one of the creation astronomers have done, and I can't quite remember his name anymore. He's written a book on it, on the heavens. But he put it in this little illustration here, that if we were to start counting the stars at 10 billion per second, how long would it take us to get to that number? 10 billion per second is about the speed that some of our fastest personal computers can compute. If I'm thinking right, I don't know, you could correct me on that. So if we have processors that are running and they're counting stars, then we have... We could let's say, for example, start this computer now, counting at 10 billion per second, and we would need to let it go for a total of 30 million years to get to that number of estimated stars within the observable universe. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, this stuff is so far beyond me. I'm not an authority in these things, even though I've been exposed to them for 20, 30 years. It is just hard for me to understand and comprehend such an amazing number like that. Whatever the case, we know that God is great and mighty and greatly to be praised. So last evening we looked at some planets, and I didn't finish it, so I wasn't able to say all that I wanted to say. But as we went through those planets, we saw that tremendous variety. There was lots of geological formations, lots of different chemical compositions, and exotic landscapes. There were geysers, there are earthquakes, there are volcanoes, all sorts of things happening on those other planets. There's interesting colors and shapes and sizes of the moons. So there's lots of variety and creativity that God has just in our solar system here, the planets in our solar system. But as astronomers have sent up a few spacecraft, and one of them especially has been designed to look for planets, like the Kepler spacecraft, they have been finding around star systems close to us lots of other planets. And they are now coming to the conclusion that there's most likely more planets in the universe than there are stars. So counting it 10 billion per second for 30 million years just gets us to the stars. But now imagine all the immense creativity that God has shown in creating lots of planets around those stars. And there would be even more worlds in our universe than there are stars themselves. So there's definitely wonders without number in the universe around us. Okay, now moving on. Looking at Isaiah 40, verse 22, it says, it is he that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. There's an expansion in the universe, apparently, because of what we see and because of what we can read in the Bible here. Thus saith God the Lord, he that created the heavens and stretched them out. Here's another one. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, stretched forth the heavens alone, who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain has stretched out the heavens by his discretion, and there's more coming there. So over and over again in the Bible, we're reading about this stretching out of the heavens. Well, in the 1920s, Edwin Hubble and George Lemaître actually discovered evidence in the universe itself, aside from the Bible, that the heavens are expanding. So secular astronomy came around to believing also that the heavens are actually expanding. They're not static and unchanging like the ancients believed. They thought that was the one unchanging part of all the universe was the starry heavens. They noticed the planets wandered around. They called those the wandering stars. But they felt that the stars above the planets were actually fixed and unchanging, immovable. But the authors of the Bible were saying, no, it's actually changing. The heavens are expanding. They're being stretched out. And like we saw earlier, the statement was also made that these things are without number. We'll look at more of that later on. And we were also looking at how that the authors of the Bible were claiming that the universe had a beginning, which people that believed, did not believe in God often just said that the universe always existed. So these things that are being written in the Bible are contrary to what the ancients believed, yet they were written because God inspired the authors to write them, and still correct, still understood to be correct after thousands of years. He hangeth the earth upon nothing. This is another one. So the earth is not supported by the giant Atlas like the Greeks believe. It's not resting on the back of four giant elephants like the Hindus believe. And the elephants, in their theory, were standing on a turtle. Why a turtle? I don't know. I guess it just made perfect sense to them. Well, the poor turtle is what I say. And this turtle, they had it swimming in an ocean. You can see it's a sea turtle. So that solved the problem. There's an equilibrium of pressures, and the turtle doesn't get crushed. But now we have an even bigger problem. Where is this giant ocean of water coming from, and what's holding up the water? So as you can see, if we reject God's ways and what he has to say about things, even if it kind of defies common sense, we only compound our problems as we go down further and further with bigger and bigger things to hold the objects that we're trying to prop up. So God is faithful in what he says. He hangs the earth upon nothing. There is no physical support for this earth. It's in its invisible gravitational bond with the sun. It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth. So the earth is round. And this is something else that the ancients didn't believe. Not all of them. Some of them felt that if you sailed too far, you'd fall off the edge of the earth. And, you know, quaint theories like that, of course. But this, in Isaiah 40, verse 22, was written sometime between 740 and 680 B.C., most likely, which makes it at least 300 years before the philosopher Aristotle was saying that the earth might be round. And then it was another 2,000 years later when the scriptures inspired Christopher Columbus to sail around the earth as well. Now, of course, Christopher Columbus wasn't the first one to realize and say that the earth is round. There was lots of others before him that said it as well. The Venerable Bede, one of the church leaders from back 1,000 years ago or so, he also said the same thing. Let's see, there's another one here. Job 26, verse 10. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. We call that the Terminator. You can see it on this picture here. And you see how it takes on a curved shape. The only way that you can have that circular horizon or curved Terminator when you have an omnidirectional light source like the sun is if it's projected onto a sphere. So this verse presupposes a round verse here. Proverbs 8:27 also says, "When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep." So the earth is round. "Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the dayspring to know his place?" Speaking about the earth here, "it is turned as clay to the seal, and they stand as a garment." So the earth is turning once every 24 hours, giving the illusion that the stars and everything are actually orbiting around the earth once a day. But that's not the case. In fact, if it was the case, then the planet, dwarf planet Pluto, which is still within our solar system and not out there in the stars, even though it's close to us, it would have to go at greater than the speed of light in order to get around the Earth once in a 24-hour period. But we go with what the Bible says, and it makes perfect sense. At a time when about 5,000 stars could be counted in the night sky, there was a statement that was recorded about the reality of the number of stars, where it says in Jeremiah 33:22, "As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea measured." So telescopes today show us this is true. Instead of there being only 5,000 or 6,000 stars that can be seen in the sky, we actually have a basically unlimited number of stars for all practical purposes. We just really can't count them. And you see how those two numbers are compared as well in the Bible, as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These two scriptures are comparing the number of stars with the number of sand grains on all the beaches around the world. And it's interesting that people who have tried to calculate the numbers of these two, they come out at roughly the same place. Now, of course, there could still be a huge gulf or gap between the total number of, or between the numbers of the totals of stars and sand, but it's close enough that you could say it's roughly the same. All right, now we can also see how that the first law of thermodynamics is understood to be the most firmly established law in science, and it states that the total quantity of matter and energy in the universe is a constant. Now, according to the famous little equation E equals mc squared, we can actually take energy and convert it into matter, or take matter and convert it into energy. So we can go back and forth between the two, but the total quantity of the two always stay the same. So if we have an increase in energy, we have a corresponding decrease in matter in our universe. And that's all according to the first law of thermodynamics, or it fits into there. But it reminds us of what we can read in Genesis 2:1-2, where it says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them, and on the seventh day God ended his work which he had made." So creation was finished at that point, and there was not an additional input into the universe here. There's no additional input in the sense of matter or energy. Now, God, of course, affects things. He takes this matter, this energy that he has made, and he moves it around. He can create, he can do miracles and things like that. But as a whole, creation is finished. God ended, on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made. Let's see here. The second law of thermodynamics is a very well-established law that states everything in the universe is deteriorating, running down, and tending to disorder. And historically, most people believed that the universe was unchangeable, yet modern science shows that the universe is growing old like a garment, like Hebrews 1:11 tells us. Magnetic fields are wearing out, stars are slowly burning out, and our bodies are growing old and will eventually decay into piles of dust. "Thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth. The heavens are the works of thine hands. They shall perish, but thou remainest, and they all shall wax old as doth a garment." So thermodynamics is revealed in the Bible as well. Romans 8:22 says, "For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now." So this is a very well-established law beyond any dispute, but in some ways, evolution directly contradicts this law. So we've looked at a lot of things this morning in these verses, and we can see that the preacher says, "Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath been already of old time which was before us?" So a lot of these scriptures that we looked at would have been scoffed at the time they were written because of what contemporary philosophy was like back in that time. But of course today we know that it's true, not only because of what science says, but because of it being found in the Bible. Okay, let us take a look at some of the things that have a bearing on the things that we find in the creation story. So, for example, one here is on measuring time. All of our major time units are based on creation principles. For example, a day is one Earth rotation, 24 hours or 23 hours and 56 minutes, to be a little more precise. And then 1 month is the rotation or the orbit of the moon around the Earth. It's roughly based on that. And then 1 year is based on one orbit of the Earth around the sun. Now, there's one very familiar unit of measurement of time that's left out here and that we do not have an astronomical basis for, unlike these other three. And it's found right here between these two. Nestled in, it's 1 week. So where does that come from? Where do we get our concept of a week? We get it from that 7-day work and rest period of creation. And it's God's perfect way for us to live in a work and rest cycle. And there have been, you've probably heard stories about the Russians or others that have tried different cycles, like maybe 5-day cycle, and it just didn't work, and eventually they just reverted back to the 7-day cycle. So that's an interesting observation there. And then we can also see things like the Earth, magnetic field that's decaying. And the magnetic field is what makes a compass point north. You're probably familiar with that. Dr. Russell Humphreys, who has a PhD in physics, he has made predictions based on a 6,000-year-old creation of what the magnetic field strengths of other planets should be. And he made predictions for the strengths of the magnetic fields of Uranus and Neptune well before those magnetic fields were measured by the Voyager spacecraft. And his predictions were right on, whereas the predictions of evolutionists were not. So this shows some of the reliability of the basis that we can use on the scripture of discovering things. And of course, the Bible is not a science textbook, and there are some cases where that there is phenomenological language that's used or metaphorical language, so we have to understand it in that context as well. We can't just take anything in the Bible and assume that it's referring to something that is outside of the bounds of poetic or metaphoric language, because the Bible definitely does use that. But it's fairly easy to figure out where the Bible is using that and where it's not. Another thing that we can do here is take a look at the distances to the stars and see how this is actually done and see if these distances are reliable. And I mentioned a little bit this morning about the starlight and time issue that we have. And so I'd like to look at that here now. And one thing that we did was we looked at the evolutionist solution to the problem, and it was the inflation theory that's supposed to solve the horizon problem. And if you remember, the universe would expand 10 to the 78th times bigger in just one fraction of a femtosecond. But, of course, that doesn't seem to be a good solution. So let's take a look at some other possibilities here. First, we'll take a look at how we get the distance to the stars, how we discover those distances. One way is by looking at stellar parallax. As the Earth goes around the sun in its orbit once per year, we cover almost 200 million miles of space between here and here. And stars that are close by to us, they will look like they're, as we form a triangle, it looks like it's a depressed triangle, squashed down, just simply speaking. And if we look at stars that are farther away, you'll have steeper angles to the triangle. So this is just a really simplified, exaggerated visual explanation for stellar parallax. So the farther the stars are from us, the steeper the angles of the triangle. And as we look at this star, over the course of this 1 year orbit around the sun, this star would appear to shift in position relative to the background stars way out here. So looking at the amount of shift that this star would have, that parallax shift, it would help, it lets us know how far away it is from us. There's other stars that are even further, and so in that case, we can use what's called the redshift interpretation. Stars that are close to us have absorption lines in the spectrum that are shifted toward the blue end. Stars that are farther away from us have absorption lines that are shifted toward the red end of the spectrum. How does this work? Well, it has to do with the redshift of starlight. And stars, the light from stars coming to us have these absorption lines, these dark lines in the spectrum. You can see it in the light of all stars coming to us, the light coming to us from all stars. And it comes from stars' chemical composition absorbing some of that light before it sends it out. We can get the chemical composition of things on the Earth by using the same method. For example, you could look at a candle burning, and you could take that spectrum of light, you could split it into the colors, and you would be able to see, if you'd have a spectrograph, you could see absorption lines in there. And what that comes from is that the elements that cause the candle to actually burn would be absorbing some of that light before it leaves the candle. So when the light comes to us, then it's just missing that light. And that's what happens with the stars. So we can see what the stars are made of by looking at where these absorption lines are. And they take on a particular pattern as well, where there's dark areas and then a certain distance of light, and then dark again and then light. And you can look at those distances and you can determine lots of things. Well, that whole set of absorption lines is shifted toward the red end of the spectrum if stars are moving away from us. So it's similar to the Doppler effect that you have with sound. For example, if you're sitting at a train track and you hear the train engine coming and he's blowing his horn, the pitch of the horn is higher as he's coming toward us, and then it drops lower as he goes away from us. And that's because of the compression and rarefaction of the sound waves. Well, light behaves in similar ways. So as a star is moving toward us, absorption lines are shifted into the blue end of the spectrum. As it's moving away from us, the absorption lines are shifted into the red end of the spectrum. We can see this even with the planet Jupiter. It's interesting that we can get this observational evidence of this absorption line shift. For example, what you see right here is a little section of light. I'm just looking at the specs over here on the left to see if we can get any information out of that. I hadn't really looked at that before. It looks like it was taken by an 11-inch telescope. But anyway, moving on here, we have these absorption lines that are shifted up toward the right. Or on the right, they're shifted up, and toward the left, they're shifted down. Well, on the right side of the planet is approaching us because it's turning, and on the left, it's receding away from us. So on the left side here, the absorption lines are shifted downward into the red end. You see there's red down here, blue up there, but on the right, they're shifted up toward the blue end. So you can see that subtle shift there as we look at the cross-section of Jupiter. The expansion of the universe is something that we can think of now. As we are here, we can have stars moving away from us or toward us if they're close to where we are at position A. So if the stars are moving toward us, we can see them blue shifted, and if they're moving away from us, we can see them red shifted. Now, if we're looking at the other side of the universe out here at position C, there's so much area for the universe to expand that roughly everything is moving away from us. So as we expand this, you can see that A and B are moving apart from each other, but not as fast as A and C are. So the farther we look across the universe, the faster things are moving away from us, and therefore, the more redshifted that light will be. So that light is moving into the red end of the spectrum, and when we look at galaxies way out here on the other side of the universe, we're looking so far into the red end of the spectrum that the galaxies are basically invisible, and that's one of the main reasons why the James Webb Space Telescope was built and launched, was to make so that we could see that invisible light. And even though the James Webb Space Telescope is tuned to look for light deep into the red end of the spectrum, there's still galaxies that the James Webb Space Telescope can't see. That light is just going into invisibility, so it's kind of like trying to look over the horizon. There's a point where it just becomes impossible. Even though there's still things out there, you can't see them. You can't see them all. So gravity distorts time. This is another thing to keep in mind as we keep putting pieces of this puzzle together. Gravity distorts time. If you have a clock on the top of a high mountain away from the Earth, then time appears to be moving faster. If you have a clock down in the valley, time appears to be moving slower because it's closer to the mass of the Earth. And in a sense, gravity not only pulls down on stuff, on things, on matter, but also on time. So depending on where you live or where you are depends on how you view time. Time can be running differently under different gravity influences. So where there's a lot of matter, gravity will distort time and cause it to move slower. In fact, at the boundary of a black hole, which is at the Schwarzschild radius away from the center of it, that's called the event horizon out here. At that event horizon, time is moving so slowly, it's basically standing still, according to theoretical physicists. And another thing that we can notice that has a practical effect on our everyday life is that our GPS devices, they triangulate our position by sending signals or pings to satellites above. And they can triangulate the position that we have based on the amount of time that elapses between the pinging of those satellites. And so those satellites have to have extremely precise time clocks on them. But since they are above the Earth and they're moving at higher speeds, those two things cause the flow rate of time on those satellites to be different than the flow rate of time here on the Earth. And there is a continual compensation made for that. And if they wouldn't make that continual compensation, then within a few minutes, our GPS systems would lose their accuracy, and after a few hours, the whole system would be useless because of that time dilation effect throwing things off. So Dr. Russell Humphreys and Dr. John Hartnett have come up with some theories that show how that the clocks on the Earth could have been very slow on the fourth day of creation, whereas clocks out in the far reaches of the universe could have been moving faster, or time could have been moving faster, and it would have given enough time to see the galaxies. So the implications of this are really interesting and exciting. When we take what the Bible says about the expansion of the universe and we combine this with what we've learned with relativity and physics, we can see that there is an opportunity for light travel time to be, that question to be solved by looking at how that there's time is flowing different in different parts of the universe. So I put together a little illustration here that shows how that this could have happened. So in the beginning, we could have the Earth at close to the center of the universe, and there's good evidence for this because of what we see in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, where there are quantized redshifts of galaxies, which basically means that we can go out a distance and we see a ring of galaxies around us, and then we go another distance and there's basically a void, and then another distance, another ring. So the only way that we would expect to see that all surrounding us is if it were at some bullseye in the center of something. So there's good evidence that we could be in the center of close to the center of the universe based on that. And if we take this and we play it forward, I'll just run it here so you can see what will be happening. Now we'll go back and look at it again. What we have here is the original universe. All these black dots represent the galaxies out there in the universe. And everything was in a smaller place in the beginning, but God created the heavens and stretched them out. So as this matter is spread out, gravity decreases. And as the matter spreads out, time actually speeds up. Because there's less matter there, gravity isn't as strong. It's not pulling down on time. There's not a direct relationship, but it's an indirect. So time speeds up. Out here in the edges where these galaxies are spreading apart, they're getting away from most of the matter in the rest of the universe, like, for example, galaxies right here as the universe expands. So time speeds up for them. And everything within this time-altering event horizon is moving at slow rates of time. But as the universe expands, this time-altering event horizon shrinks toward the Earth, and the Earth is the last part of the universe to experience this slow time rate compared to the rest of the universe. So this means that God could have created everything 6,000 years ago, but since that time, time has been moving at different rates in different parts of the universe. For example, even yet today, time right next to black holes is moving at extremely slow rates. But as we had the universe here expanding, the time-altering event horizon could have shrunk, allowing light to travel right behind that and come to the Earth after just a short amount of time, even just a couple of days, allowing Adam to see light from the Andromeda Galaxy, for example, just a few days after that all was created. So these are interesting possibilities. I'm not up here saying that this is how it was, and Dr. John Hartnett and Dr. Russell Humphreys aren't making that claim either, but it's just interesting to uncover possibilities of how God could have gotten the light here. There's also the in-transit theory, where God could have created everything and put light between us and those objects. There's some problems that go along with that, though, too. Specifically, God putting in place a fictitious rendering of events, or it could be that, you know, he just put it there on how it would have been if those galaxies would have existed that long, so it wouldn't have to be God showing us a false account. Wouldn't have to be viewed that way. Then there's also the alternate synchrony convention that Dr. Jason Lyle has postulated. And there's other theories as well, but we won't go into all of those. And of course, like was mentioned earlier, the Big Bang theorists have their own time dilation problem. So that is, in a nutshell, what we have for this morning. The next session, like was mentioned, will be about our position in this cosmos that God has created, and it's a privileged position. And it helps us to understand God's love for us. So I think that's all I have for now. And I'll turn the time over to Andrew or the next speaker.